Welcome, folks. It's the Thursday edition of Beyond the Darkness, the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader. Dave is back in the country. He's back from England, and no, he's not on the lam. We're getting ready for Michigan Paracon this weekend. Michigan Paracon, as we speak, technically is starting. I know. If you don't have your tickets yet, darknessevents.com. Click on the banner. There's a few left. It's this weekend at Keewaudin Casino in Upper Michigan in Sault Ste. Marie, and you're going to want to join us. It's going to be a great time. It's one of the few events that Dave and myself will be at this year, the other one being Chicago Ghost Conference in October. You can get tickets for either event by going to darknessevents.com. Speaking of England, Dave has another appearance yet in England in September. If you didn't join him and our many listeners in England in August, you can do it in September. Somebody's misfortune is your fortune. As it turns out, a couple of people had to drop out from that trip in September, but you can take advantage. There's a couple of spots remaining, and if you can kind of drop everything and go, do it. Do it. Have you seen some of the pictures from England on Dave's social media? They had an absolutely wonderful time, and you're going to want to join them as well. Go to darknessevents.com, click on the banner, get yourself in there for September. It's going to be an amazing time. We have a great show tonight and a very, very interesting show. I love talking conspiracy theories. In fact, my talk at Michigan Paracon is on conspiracy theories. And we've got a great guest tonight. Eric Kurlander is our guest. And we're going to be talking about Hitler's Monsters, a supernatural history of the Third Reich. You know, World War II is a favorite subject of both Dave's and mine. Both our grandfathers served in World War II. And so there's something very dark and very fascinating about the Nazis and about World War II. Eric's history is a rich one as well. Eric Kurlander teaches classes on modern German, European, and world history. His recent book, Living with Hitler, examines the ways in which German liberals negotiated, resisted, and in some ways accommodated the Third Reich. His first book, The Price of Exclusion, Ethnicity, National Identity, and the Decline of German Liberalism, describes how ethnic nationalist ideology gradually undermined the liberal parties in late imperial and... I'm bringing Weimar. Eric in. Is it Weimar?
You can say other one, but technically it's Weimar.
It's Weimar. See, this is where your ninth grade German for 3 months does nothing, because I forgot already. Weimar, Germany. His articles have appeared in Central European History, the Journal of Contemporary History, The Historian, the catalog of the German Historical Institute, Ethnopolitics, and European Review of History. Eric has held fellowships from the Fulbright Foundation, Coleman Faculty Entrepreneurship, Alexander von Humboldt Foundation, and the German Historical Institute, the German Academic Exchange Service, the Krupp Foundation, and Harvard University's Program for the Study of Germany and Europe. He's also received the Stetson University Sabbatical Award and the William Hugh McKerney Award for Excellence in Teaching. Let's welcome to the darkness. I almost said darkness on the edge of town. I'm talking about the old show. It's Beyond the Darkness. Eric Kurlander. Eric, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. That was a very generous introduction.
Well, I'm happy to be here. I appreciate you being with us tonight. It's I'll tell you, I am fascinated with World War II, not only because of the personal tie. My grandfather served in Italy, was shot in Italy, came back to the States, and because he had a brother that was over in the Japanese theater and a mother that would not take no for an answer, and as far as you're not going to leave your brother over there, re-enlisted and went to he wanted to get back over into the Japanese theater, and he got close. He got over to Corregidor in the Philippines. But one of the things that always fascinated me about World War II, and I think it fascinates a lot of people in a morbidly curious manner, is the Nazis and the Third Reich. And it's almost the enemy of all enemies. Wouldn't you agree?
One would think so, both for good, sound historical reasons and obviously popular cultural reasons in the way that the that history has been digested and reproduced the last 70 or 80 years. Yeah.
I want to talk about this right off the bat before we actually get into the supernatural history of the Third Reich. And in that, the fascination, we're more than 70 years removed from the end of the Third Reich. And yet there is this fascination. Anytime you turn over to the History Channel or any of the channels that deal with history, you're staring directly into the face of archived footage of Adolf Hitler. There's not that much archived footage of Stalin or Mussolini or any of the leaders of that time. You don't see a lot of archived footage of FDR or Truman or you know, any of those leaders as much as you do of Adolf Hitler. Now, I realize there was ego involved, and Hitler probably had a lot of archived footage. But what is it that we glorify this, to quote the cover of your book, this monster of all monsters?
It's a great question, and obviously it's not directly related to the topic of the book, but German historians have kind of struggled with this for many years because we want to obviously have an audience for our work, and yet at the same time, as European historians and historians of you know, world history, we want to make comparisons, and people just don't seem as fascinated by, you know, the crimes of Stalin or Pol Pot. Or
Mao killed 50 million, for example, so he killed four times as many civilians, forgetting about the rest of the casualties of the war, in comparison to Hitler. So it's not, our fascination isn't linked purely to the monstrosity or the scale of the crimes. It's also a fascination with the actors in that historical drama. And for us as German historians, the debate we've always been having is to what degree does Germany represent the modern world or the Western world? And that explains the fascination because there's so much like us. If you look at German leadership in science and culture and the arts and the diversity of the German-speaking world, Austria, Germany, Switzerland, this is not a foreign entity to those people in the West who are so fascinated by it, unlike maybe the Soviet Union or China, which for Europeans who are kind of Eurocentric or Americans, well, you know, that's a different part of the world, right? So I think we would say it's our fascination with ourselves or what we're capable of that we see in the Third Reich, though many Americans and British wouldn't admit that. That's part of the draw, I would say.
I would agree with that. There's that looking in the mirror and seeing yourself aspect of things. But I think, too, is it the twisted, I'm going to use Star Trek lingo here, that twisted mirror version of ourselves where we're staring in the mirror and it's that evil part of ourselves. It's that part where, you know what, we could see ourselves. That's us if we took it maybe just a little bit too far.
Exactly. The Holocaust, too, I think, you know, if the Third Reich collapses in 1941, you'd still have an incredible fascination, certainly greater than Mussolini's Italy. But I don't know it would have the same morbid or almost satanic or demonic reputation that it has because of the next 2 years, right? Because between the end of 41 and the end of 43, the Nazis systematically killed 3 or 4 million of all the Jews they killed during the war. And that crime alone magnifies for many you know, the evil and the monstrosity of the Third Reich.
I want to play a little what if with you for a second here, Eric, because I do find this era of history fascinating. And I'll play What If in the vein of, let's say that Hitler's rise isn't as prominent as we say it is right now. Let's say Hitler is more a leader in the vein of Mussolini. Let's say Mussolini and Hitler switch places. Okay. But Mussolini is not, it doesn't commit the atrocities that, that Hitler does. They still want to conquer the world. They still want to take up real estate. They still want to infringe on others, but there is no Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, the Allied powers get together. They defeat the Axis powers. Do you think that there is a void filled by Stalin? And do you think at that point the world war continues when the U.S. turns its attention to Stalin, thinking that, you know what, it was easy to defeat the Axis powers. The Soviet Union can't be that much more difficult. Do you think because of the combined might and the atrocities suffered in World War II, everything from the Holocaust to the fact that the sheer devastation of the atomic bombs, do you think the combination of the two was just too much horror, too much devastation? It was just too much. It's time to stop.
I'm not quite following the counterfactual. Is the counterfactual more about our relationship with the Soviet Union if the Axis collapses in 42 before our alliance? Or is it about what the world might look like if the war ends in 42?
I think it's a little bit more about if a little of both. If the war ends in 42, and if the Nazis aren't the evil empire that they are, they don't commit the atrocities that they are, yet you still have the tyrant that's Stalin, and you still have the reputation that's Stalin. You have the gulags. You have
right. Okay. So that helps. So first of all, obviously Stalin killed most of the people he was going to kill directly with the first 2 5-year plans between 28, 29, and 39. Mm-hmm. So most of his worst atrocities, including the Ukrainian famine, the Holodomor, occurred, on our watch, and we didn't really care. And no one was saying, let's intervene. I mean, the Soviet Union was a pariah nation, and certainly those crimes influenced our lack of willingness to form an alliance with the Soviet Union, as we had with Russia. So before World War I, France, Britain, and Russia formed an alliance, and America joined that alliance, right, mm-hmm. against Germany and Austria, and initially Italy. In the lead-up to World War II, between the combination of isolationism and hatred of communism, we rebuffed Stalin's attempts to form that kind of two-front alliance. And some of that was linked not just to an ideological hatred of communism, but the awareness that he was killing lots of people. But we weren't raising that as a major human rights issue. I mean, the West, America, Britain, and France. So there's little reason to suspect, if the war doesn't continue in, past 41 or 42, that we would have continued on into the Soviet Union unless, and here's the reason the Cold War did develop, Stalin took advantage of that to advance all the way into the middle of Germany and try to split Europe up between, communism and capitalism. Part of the reason you had Churchill in, mid-45 saying we should continue on is by that point, with the vacuum that had been created from all that, additional 3.5 years of devastation, there was no bulwark against communism. Poland had been occupied. All the other, Hungary, all these countries that had been, supposedly liberated were de facto now, in his mind, communist satellites. And he was so worried about that he said, maybe we should continue on. Roosevelt, of course, and Eisenhower said that makes no logistical sense. They're still technically our allies. We're not going to do that. So I don't know that kind of angst would have existed in 42. And Stalin, of course, may not have had the opportunity then to extend as far west. So if that counterfactual has so many other moving parts, it's hard to say, but I think that gives you an answer to the question.
Yeah, absolutely. And gets a good idea of kind of setting the stage of where I guess we're going here in this segment. my next question, I guess, with that being considered, is why do you think after World War II we did not, and again, we're getting a little off topic, but I'd like to wrap up this point. Why do you think, in your opinion, we did not move on and move forward to the Soviet Union? What was the Allied powers, not just the U.S., but the Allied powers' reason for stopping at that point, knowing that Stalin had come forward into Germany and that it was time to break up into West and East Germany, and why the settlement with Stalin?
Well, we have to get into the chronology. It's really important. As late as December, I believe, of 44, Churchill on his own, or the British, had reached out to Stalin, not knowing quite when the war was going to end and knowing they still had the Pacific to deal with, right? Mm-hmm. And basically said, and not in so many words, that if you let us get Greece, because Greece had a bunch of communist, anti-fascist militia running around who were helping the Allies, but they were communist. And Churchill didn't want Greece, you know, the font of Western civilization and a really important strategic area run by communists. So he said, if you pull out of there and don't try to foist communism on Greece, we'll kind of look the other way with the Yugoslavia. And Stalin took that as, okay, we're going to basically start now dividing up Eastern Europe as the war in Europe ends, and that I got a tacit okay to do it. Now, I'm not saying Stalin wouldn't have done that otherwise. I'm saying that there were signals that, look, we're going to have to divvy this up, and let's make some deals. In February at Yalta, there was still talk of doing that, right? So now Stalin had gotten into Poland, and there was, well, so what's going to happen with Poland? And basically the gist was, if you let us have France as one of the powers that are going to occupy Germany, because we don't want to just have to do it alone, we can use France being a strong power again, which of course at the time was hardly pro-communist. We're not going to make too much of a big deal about what kind of elections you hold in Poland, right? Mm-hmm. And Roosevelt was very concerned in February and March about getting Stalin's agreement to help out in the Pacific. So now that the things are winding down in Germany, hey, you know, we're losing huge amounts of casualties in, you know, Okinawa, whatever is occurring now in the spring of I think that's April of 45, and even earlier than that, you know, obviously the Philippines campaign was very bloody, 43, 44. So Roosevelt saying, we could use you, and Stalin agrees. Now, of course, he had ulterior motives. Why not divide up Asia as well? So it would be very hard, given those negotiations and signals, all of a sudden, even though Roosevelt dies and Truman comes in June, July, to say, okay, now let's just ignore all of that and the fact that we've been allies for 4 years, and let's conquer this entire region of the world that the Nazis couldn't conquer because we don't like communism. I know MacArthur wanted to kind of do that, and I know Churchill made some, you know, some comments along those lines, but it really would have been irrational, countered all these delicate negotiations. We were still technically allies. Obviously, things got worse in the summer of, you know, at Potsdam. I think James Burns, who was the Secretary of State, basically walked up to Stalin, who knew from his own Secret Service that we were testing nuclear bombs, and said, we've got this great new weapon. We're not sure we're going to need your help anymore in the Pacific, certainly not in occupying Japan, and we're probably going to use this weapon. So why don't you stand down a little bit over there, which is counter to what we had asked them to do at Yalta. It was a signal to Stalin, obviously, that we could use these bombs anywhere. So things were getting nasty, but there still wasn't this sense that we're going to try to fight over the entire world in a hot war with the Soviet Union, if that makes sense. So that chronology, those few months between February, March, and June, July are important, but there just wasn't the critical mass of support for just extending such a horrible war east. I just don't think that was ever really on the table.
Understood. Let's rewind, and let's rewind back to the beginnings of Nazi Germany. When Hitler takes power, and you know, we have this idea of the Nazis, and when we hear about the supernatural aspect of the Nazis, we get the idea that it was Himmler, and it was his obsession, and he was the one that introduced it. But we're a little bit mistaken about that, aren't we?
Right. So So if we're starting already in 33, I'll need to give a little context for that. Mm-hmm. So if you had to pick the one high ranking Nazi who really had his hand in every one of the, you know, cookie jars of supernatural thinking, the pagan religion, the border scientific and miraculous weapons and technologies, and occultism, you know, traditional esoteric thinking and practice, Himmler would be the one you'd pick. Himmler and probably Hess, in some ways, were invested in all those three areas, which I divide up in the book. I say the supernatural imaginary that infuses so much of the Third Reich, could divide it into, you know, traditional occultism, border science, and pagan religion. And Hess and Himmler were invested in all three. But what I argue, and I think this is what you're getting at, is that almost every Nazi was in some ways invested in one of those three things, right? If you look at the cluster of ideas that go along with one of those three kind of pillars of what I call the supernatural imaginary, Hitler definitely dabbled in or was fascinated by aspects of occultism, or influenced by tropes and themes that occultists had come up with, like, you know, the swastika, or the idea of root races that might have mystical, even supernatural or extraterrestrial origins. He was invested in some of the Eastern religiosity, New Age, paganist ideas that, you know, clusters that influenced the pagan religion, and border science. He had a dowser, check the Reich Chancellery, you know, a pendulum dowser, a radiesthesiologist, as they called it in scientific terms, for death rays. So you can find ways that Hitler even dabbled in or was fascinated by parapsychology as well. He read a parapsychological book. We're 90% sure he read and annotated it. It was in his library, had his handwriting in it. So Hitler, who's usually seen as one of the greater skeptics and wanted to rein in Himmler and criticize wandering scholars clothed in bearskins who basically saw as impractical as politicians, right? He still dabbled in it. And we could go down the line and show how a lot of Nazi leaders, Goebbels as well, and I don't know how much time we have to do this, it's pretty systematic in the book, dabbled in one or more of these three areas, right? Mm-hmm. So yes, Himmler is the kind of doyen of this kind of thinking, and Hess, but many more Nazis were immersed in some aspect of what I call this supernatural imaginary.
Let's cover this real quick before we go to break. Let's start with something simple as, or maybe as complex as the swastika. When the Nazis are forming and the Nazi Party is forming, and you have to have a symbol, you have to have something that inspires power at the same time, shows the world that you mean business, or something memorable that sticks in people's minds, you come up with a symbol. And with the Nazis, it was the swastika. Why the swastika? What was it about this symbol and the way that they presented this symbol? Because I'm sure you can explain to our audience what the symbol was originally and what it, why it became what it became. Why the presentation of the symbol the way it was? Did they present it this way? And what were they trying to convey to the world with the way they presented it?
Right. So it's such a great question, and there's so many directions to go with this. Let me start. I'm not a religious studies scholar, but obviously the swastika in some version, sometimes inverted, is very prevalent in the ancient Middle East, northern Southeast Asia, northern India. There's even examples of it in Native American traditions. In terms of the Near East and Asia, it often was a symbol for the sun or the sun wheel, or a lot of, at least the interpretation of many scholars of Indo-Aryan culture, said it represented something related to the sun and fertility, and or fertility. Again, that's something for religious studies scholars. What's important for our purposes is it became very much a part of this folkish, this racialist esoteric subculture that experienced a resurgence in the late 19th century. So whether you were a German, Austrian, Hungarian, Indo-Aryan thinker, an Indologist, so someone who studies India, some Anglo-Saxon scholars like Eustace Stuart Chamberlain, you started to be fascinated by the swastika as this kind of signifier of ancient Indo-Aryan culture, religion, and race, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not that the Nazis invented it. It's, and this is an argument in the first three chapters of the book, the Nazis are merely picking and choosing already popular themes and symbols from the subcultures and milieu out of which they come, right? There are all sorts of occult orders and pagan or what you might call German Christian or Aryo-Christian or Aryo-Germanic religious groups, pseudo-Darwinian thinkers who are drawing more on the mysticism of Aryosophy or Anthroposophy or Theosophy of Madame Blavatsky than they are on any real science of eugenics. And not that eugenics is a real science, but at least it was supposedly embedded in genetics and biology. The stuff they're coming up with about root races and a third eye and Atlantis really had no basis in biology. And all of these people are appropriating the swastika. That's kind of a unifying symbol. You see it on all sorts of occult journals. You see it as a symbol of a lot of the racist late kind of imperial German and Austrian, right before World War One, during World War One. It's on the books that they're publishing. It's if they have a book of runes, there'll be a swastika on it. So it's not surprising at all that the Nazis who come out of the Thule Society, the Thule Gesellschaft, which is an occult society formed at the end of World War One in Munich, an Aryosophic group in many ways, one of these occult traditions that were very popular in Vienna and Munich. Why not appropriate that and put it on your flag? It was so obviously a unifying symbol. So the question isn't where do they get this obscure thing from? It's how could they not use that as at least one of their main emblems, right? When along with the death's head, which also has a long tradition in folkish, esoteric, paramilitary groups going back to the 19th century. They didn't invent this stuff. Right, the werewolf organization, the Artemon in the 20s, they were all using some version of the death's head. My argument is they're just appropriating and systematizing and selectively utilizing ideas that come out of this broader supernatural imaginary, which is why it's so effective. Right.
Right. Interesting stuff. Let's take our break right here, Eric. Eric Kurlander is our guest. The book is Hitler's Monsters, A Supernatural History of the Third Reich. And Eric, where can people pick up the book?
It's available in many bookstores. I know that Barnes & Noble has been carrying it, for example. It's available on Amazon, North America, so Canada, the United States, Great Britain, and obviously online and other venues, including, you know, Barnes & Noble and Walmart and those kinds of things. So you can get it pretty easily in a day or two.
All right.
Any of those places.
We'll have a link to it as well in the comments section at podcast1.com.
Right. And
Beyond and
directly from the Yale University Press website. Obviously, it's Yale University Press. I want to make sure my publisher gets a nod here, so you can get it directly from Yale as well.
Absolutely. Yale University Press, you said?
Yes.
All right. When we come back, the Nazis are into much, much more than just the symbolism of the swastika. Witchcraft, miracle weapons, the lost kingdom of Atlantis, as Eric mentioned, and much, much more. We'll get into what exactly in the supernatural the Third Reich was into. That'll come up next here on Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader. Our guest is Eric Kurlander. The book is Hitler's Monsters, A Supernatural History of the Third Reich, available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and where you can find books online. We've got a link on the podcast1.com page for Beyond the Darkness, so you can find it easily and go ahead and get it right now. Fascinating book. Before the break, Eric, we were talking about different things that the Nazis had dipped into to give themselves the edge and also to give themselves a bit of an outlook on what their philosophy was going to be. One of the things I had mentioned was the Kingdom of Atlantis. And, you know, before the break, during the break, I had mentioned Leah Remini's program about Scientology, which is a very interesting program. And it's one of the more modern day, some people would say cult, some people definitely say religion, established religion, but it's out there and it scares a lot of people. But the Nazis adopted kind of an interesting philosophy from the Kingdom of Atlantis that I don't think most of us do. Can you explain what that was?
Sure, sure. And in fact, we can work backward from Scientology. And again, I'm no expert on Scientology, but my understanding of it is it's this combination of a kind of religion and a science, right? Or a popular science that's supposed to help you reach your greatest potential. But the premise behind it is it has all these supernatural, extraterrestrial kind of foundations for which there's no evidence whatsoever, right? Mm-hmm. And it mirrors in many ways, L. Ron Hubbard was a science fiction writer before he became a religion, Scientology leader, whatever you want to call it, cult leader. And he was growing up in the first half of the 20th century in this period when, whether it's Germany, Austria, France, Britain, or America, there's this kind of new fascination with alternative religions, with border science, the sciences which we would now maybe call occult sciences that, you know, can't necessarily be proven to provide answers in the way that empirical natural science can. But that's only because most people hadn't yet mastered these various kind of scientific practices, whether it's, you know, clairvoyance or telepathy or dowsing. And there's a return of the repressed there. And that influences what I call the supernatural imaginary across Europe and the United States. And in many ways, Scientology is an outgrowth of that. And Scientology mirrors the fascination with Atlantis, which, you know, people debated in Germany and Austria, but almost everyone who was fascinated by it agreed there had been a lost civilization that was way ahead of its time, either because it was a superior race to all the other races and it evolved far past them already 3,000, 4,000 years ago, or it was founded by extraterrestrials who had come to Earth and kind of mated with human beings who were of a lower race and created a super race. You see some Nazis and people who were affiliated with the Nazis who would kind of mention both kinds of explanations. But the fact that that also mirrors later on, let's say, Scientology, shows you how widespread this desire for a new kind of organic amalgam of science and religion was, right? Because traditional religion was declining in the 19th century. People were going to church less. As Max Weber said, there was a disenchantment of the world. People kind of understood or were forced to try to understand things in an empirical way. And something had to replace that spiritual vacuum. And in Germany and Austria, theosophy, ariosophy, anthroposophy, these three major occult doctrines, which all were founded on the idea of a lost civilization of Atlantis, or what the ariosophists called it, the Thule, Hyperborea, this kind of ancient Aryan Nordic civilization, that kind of filled that gap. And it merged science and religion the way Scientology does. So I guess my point here is Scientology is an attempt to do the same thing at the, you know, in a more or less the same period or maybe a decade or two later. And so we shouldn't be surprised that this was so popular in Germany and Austria, because millions of Americans and people worldwide have been fascinated by Scientology, which is no more or less plausible than these other theories of a lost ancient, possibly extraterrestrial super race, right? So, yeah, that gives you a kind of context for all this other, all this thinking that goes on in Central Europe.
Am I far off by saying psychologically, if you mix science, politics, and religion, you create a stronger bonding agent mentally to an administration?
Well, exactly, right? So that, and that's the chicken and the egg argument that, that historians and political scientists well before me have been arguing about and will continue to. To what degree Nazism created a political religion, right? Mm-hmm. I move away. That's a concept that a lot of political scientists have used, and I don't find it helpful because most people believe in the concept of political religion say, well, with the disenchantment of the world, politics that's done in a very showy, sacred, sacralized way with torches and speeches and mass rallies and talk about the folk and the and blood and soil, that starts to replace traditional religion. And so politics becomes a religion, right? But it's still secular, and it's still about the state and about the party. My argument in this book is, well, there's elements of that in Nazism, but they're actually drawing on supernatural doctrines and theories that have nothing to do with politics per se, but as you suggest, help bond people to the otherwise irrational and contradictory social and political views that the Nazis embrace. You, there's no empirical way, and this we'll get to maybe at the end, there's no empirical way to prove the things that the Nazis said about how the world works in domestic or foreign policy. Like many fascist movements, they were great at diagnosing some problems, but their solutions were utterly contradictory. So how do you create that kind of spiritual glue? You draw on already widely popular but completely non-empirical and unprovable doctrines that that convince people you have answers when you couldn't possibly have answers, right? And that's, I think, the chicken and the egg. Did the Nazis believe in all this stuff? Many did, I argue. But to the degree that they didn't believe in it, it was still very useful as a bonding agent to get people into the movement and convince them in a kind of millenarian sense in this thousand-year Reich, which was so much more kind of inspiring than the traditional, you know, the socialists and communists fighting over Marxist doctrine, and the liberals saying, of course, Marxism is wrong, but we do need some kind of state intervention. And then the left liberals and the right liberals fighting out over capitalism. And then you get the Great Depression. This is all so depressing and complicated for, and then, you know, the parliamentary procedures for the average German who's suffered so much, you know, between the war and inflation and depression. And then you have a party that's already appealing to this, this very popular supernatural cluster of ideas that are already there and drawing on them or using similar language or making little nods, which we see today. I mean, what's so scary about this, but fascinating for a historian, what you don't say or how you say what you say, you know, there are certain groups that get what you're getting at, right? So when our current president refuses to just call out certain groups by name and creates false equivalencies, those groups that are racist or mystical or have bizarre views about white national utopia, they see that as, well, he's really speaking to us, right? By not mentioning Jews on Holocaust Remembrance, they see he's actually anti-Semitic. Don't worry about the fact that his daughter married a Jew. That's the kind of thing the Nazis did really well. They didn't have to wear bearskins and jump around a fire and talk about runic alphabets to appeal to the people who were fluent in those things. They still recognized in a party that's having mystical marches and talking about Thor and having a swastika on their flag, they got it, right? It was a mainstreaming of all these marginal ideas. And so I see that that's always been what the far-right, alt-right, fascist groups have been trying to do. And we're seeing a little of that again today in the alt-right. So anyway, that, again, I'm trying to, as historians often do, try to provide a bridge So what is it, whether it's Scientology or the alt-right today, that, you know, we can see in the past? And then how do we better understand the past to maybe improve the present, right?
Well, I have one more point about the present, too, which confounds me, Eric, and that's this. You have, and not pointing fingers at any parties anywhere in the world, but you seem to have political parties that can put together the scientific and with policy, and you have parties that can put together the religious aspect with policy, but you don't have a party yet that's put together the trifecta that has the answers for political policy, that has the scientific rhetoric or knowledge, or the physical knowledge of how to rule, I guess, and then has the religious or is in touch with the religious side of their country. And to me, it seems like there's some obvious answers and there's some not so obvious answers. To me, it would seem like you could say, well, in most countries these days, Tim, there are too many religions in each country or too many different offshoots of religion to be able to unite a nation the way that Nazi Germany united their nation.
Well, the whole, let's be careful about saying they only lasted 12 years. Mm-hmm. They didn't unite the nation. They never got more than 40% of the vote. So for all their efforts, they still failed to do that, which most there's no long-term, there's no end game when you're relying on irrationality and all these bizarre worldviews. You can't possibly ever prove that your policies work. It's either a mask for doing the, you know, for the status quo, which eventually people figure out, or you're actually going to try those ideas, which will lead to genocide, war, and destruction. There's nothing that good that could ever come out of it in the long term. It didn't work in the long term. It was merely a short-term solution to otherwise complex problems, which we've been dealing with since the French Revolution. Just to jump ahead and I think partly answer your question, the whole, both, whether it's the American or the French Revolution, the one commonality of both those revolutions, and let's take the English Revolution in the 17th century, mm-hmm. which had its religious elements. The outcome of all of it is we cannot resolve questions by foisting a religion on the entire population, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Even the Reformation in Germany, which was in a way a religious revolution, the outcome is, well, you know what, depending on where you live, you can pick your poison, so to speak. You want to be Catholic here and Calvinist there and Lutheran there, fine. We're not going to resolve this. We're not going to be able to unite our country based on religion. The English Revolution said, you know what, we can't make everyone Catholic. Clearly they don't want that. Not everyone wants to be Anglican. Not everyone wants to be Puritan. What we can have is a parliament and a Bill of Rights and an act of toleration of all religions. And if you look at the American and French revolutions, it's more or less the same agreement, right? Religion is just too much faith-based and too complex, and as you say, too diverse to provide the glue for a modern, diverse country with lots of social divisions already, geographic. The problem is always when you try to bring the return of the repressed, try to bring religion and faith back in. Tocqueville was fascinated by that when he came to America. How are they able to have a democracy where so many people remain devout? Because in France, the whole basis of republicanism is you separate church and state, mm-hmm. right? The Catholic Church was not going to run anything anymore. In America, you claim to separate church and state, and technically the Constitution was very clear about that. But all these people remained very religious and somehow didn't see a contradiction between voting and debating policy and still being very evangelical or Catholic. And Tocqueville found that fascinating. So I guess what I would say is it's very difficult to unite religion and democracy. It's very easy to fall back into theocracy. And when we're talking about the supernatural imaginary, in many ways, it's just the modern kind of scientifically reconstrued or regurgitated version of a faith-based view of the world, right? You can't get away with just making everyone Catholic or Protestant. The Nazis themselves recognized, you know, we're not going to tell people what to believe in terms of traditional religion. But if we can take elements of what's popular – and meld that with our own beliefs on race and empire and space and history, maybe we can create some kind of new organic folkish
unity, corporate unity,
that the Italian fascists and Franco, we're all trying to do that in some way, but the Franco and Mussolini could rely on a homogeneous Catholic nation, so they were much closer to working with the Catholic Church as a kind of entity within that new fascist organic whole. The Nazis were in a country like America that was religiously divided, so they were allergic to that. For them, going fully Protestant or Catholic made no sense.
Right.
What they had to do is transcend religion and religious divisions.
I guess what I'm trying to get at, and you kind of brushed on it here just about a minute or two ago, was it seems to me if you were going to do that in the modern day, especially in a country like America or even, as you're pointing out, in different countries where religion is not necessarily the unifying factor – it would seem to me that all it would take would be a political candidate to use a catchphrase, a be-all catchphrase for God that would mean one God for all, which would be something like just calling it the Creator. You know,
well, that's
creator.
Too, that's too vague. I think, I mean, the founding fathers, who were mostly deists, and said, if you read a lot of the stuff that Jefferson and Madison and Washington said about, like, a Mohammedan could be a, would be a better citizen than a, you know, radically religious person, or, you know, our goal isn't to, you know, they were so progressive by the standards of the time, and yet they constantly talked about the Creator and, you know, because that was just kind of the language you, I think that far too vague. I think if you're going to attract people, you've got to use at least code words or show an understanding of their subculture, right?
True.
The subculture that they're already immersed in. It can't be too abstract.
Right, true. And, you have to be able to relate, right.
And also, so the argument I make in the book is there's two ways that the Nazis exploited these ideas. One is they obviously just appropriated them, right? There's many cases where, whether it was creating a natural healing institute under Hess, or Himmler and Hitler giving money to a parapsychological institute, or using dowsing to find British battleships, they're literally sponsoring and investing money, or, you know, miracle technologies using death rays for which, or anti-gravity for which there was no scientific basis at the time. That's just directly appropriating these ideas, or creating, you know, pagan festivals of the winter solstice where they talk about Thor and Baldur. So we have that, and that alone is fascinating. But what they sponsored beyond that, both consciously and unconsciously, is what we would call in, you know, philosophical terms, an epistemology, a way of knowing, a way of viewing the world that was not grounded in empirical fact. In fact, rejected as antiquated or Jewish or materialist or socialist or liberal, people who constantly wanted you to marshal evidence and prove your point. That's something that Jews and liberals and scientists did. It's not something that pure Germans who had a faith in their race and their blood and their culture did. And I think that those are both problematic, right? The supernatural magic, the kind of supernatural doctrines that any society at any time will resort to in a crisis, those are going to vary. So evangelical Christianity is much stronger as part of our supernatural imaginary in the United States than it was in Nazi Germany. Evangelical Christianity was not an important factor, though they did appeal to racist Protestants who fetishized Luther. That was not a foundational element of their supernatural thinking. It is in America. But when you get to the abstract realm of epistemology, ways of knowing, ways of testing evidence and thinking about the world, that's common across the supernatural imaginary everywhere. It's an attempt to resolve problems outside of the messy realm of science and empirical reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you see commonalities in the way that the alt-right works in America or Europe today, and the Third Reich. So it's not that everyone believes in the same measure in Atlantis, in America now, in Germany then, or in Belgium or France now. But when you look at the cluster of ideas that are not grounded in reality, which include conspiracy theories about Muslims, Jews, Area 51, New Age religion, Jesus is coming back, ghosts and spirits. And I mean, you were mentioning, why are there paranormal radio shows? Right? Were there a bunch of paranormal radio shows in the 60s and 70s when we were fighting the Cold War?
No.
And you had a, right? So that alone shows you that the supernatural imaginary has returned. And that is not a productive way for a democracy to function, as you've suggested, right?
Well, did I? I mean, I have one.
No, but while you're looking at a critic, if you're criticizing Scientology,
right,
you have to have some distance from,
right.
You don't accept every report on the paranormal is true, right? You'd like to think.
Far from it.
Yeah. Some of it's someone's psychology. Now, obviously, maybe the premise of your show is that some of this stuff really is true.
Yes,
but my point is the fascination with it, whether you're a critical, already 100 years ago, you have to understand the original parapsychologists were some of them, I'm sure you know this better than me, were critical parapsychologists. So what they were interested in is looking at the phenomena of people thinking they could talk to spirits, or clairvoyance, understanding, or their premises, you can't, but why do they believe it? Why is there this interest all of a sudden? The church is declining in the 1890s, but now all these people think they have telekinesis, can speak to their dead grandmother. And then there were the parapsychologists like, no, they really can. Let's try and have an experiment showing it. And I don't care which side you're on in that. The fact that everyone's now talking about it, that parapsychology is a thing with journals in the 1890s and early 20s, that's important because it wasn't 40 years earlier. And that's the same thing I'd say now. Whether you're critical or faith-based towards it, since the 90s, we've seen this resurgence in America and Europe of parapsychological interest, right? Ghosts and spirits and, you know, the Kroll show had their ghost bouncer thing, right?
Right.
Whether you're making fun of it or not, it's there. And
I think, too, though, and we've talked about it on the show at length in the past, I think it's directly correlated to the fact that there's a few things. One, honestly, it's that people have moved away from the church, and people have, I think, lost a little bit of faith as the years have gone on. I think the second thing that really hit the world in general was the continuing escalation of terrorism around the world that culminated with 9/11. And I think that in the fact that it continues to this day, that it seems like no one is safe, and that security blanket has been taken away permanently.
Absolutely.
I think has now shook society as a whole. And
you're absolutely right. And I would say one more thing, the end of the Cold War, and we can get into that too. But sure. I agree with the two things you brought up. The traditional religion is once again on the wane. Not that it grew immensely after World War II, but there was in the 50s, every sociologist notes it, a kind of return to the church, the Christian Democrats in Germany, Republicans in America. So there was, you know, after a lot of secularization in the course of the 19th and early 20th century, you had this return of religion, and a traditional religion. There's always religiosity and spirituality, as you're suggesting. But then you had all these crises, right? The Cold War ends. The stability, in a way, of the world divided in two between two Western philosophies, capitalism and socialism, disappears. And all these ethnic groups and religious groups, the Samuel Huntington argument, who had been, you know, chomping at the bit to define themselves again theocratically or ethno-culturally, religiously, start killing each other. I don't care if it's Bosnia, Yugoslavia, the Middle East, Shiite, Sunni, America with the evangelical movement. Same year, it's 79 is the Iranian Revolution, right? The evangelicals say, we're getting involved in politics. We want theocracy. They won't admit that, but clearly that's part of what they want, right? And so all those things, and you're absolutely right, just like the 1890s through World War One, when the, you know, mass industrialization, technology, cars, skyscrapers, planes, you know, chemicals and medicines and trains are all scaring everyone, both away from traditional religion but in search for something else. And then you get these two horrible wars, right? We're in some kind of similar moment is what I'm arguing. But the problem for me, this is not just some neutral, interesting thing to observe. I see it as linked, as I argue in the book, to political and social solutions which are out of all proportion with reality and cause the undermining of democratic praxis. You can't have a democracy where people can articulate what their interests are in an empirical way and negotiate them. If faith comes in and values that are not grounded in some reality or outcome, you cannot resolve those. How do you resolve that if you believe that aliens or some guy rose from the dead and that's why you do what you do? You can't debate that with someone.
True. I would argue, too, as part of that argument as to why the supernatural has its comeuppance even in the last 20, 30 years, you know, as people turn to the church for security, for comfort, there's a bit of an outdated outlook by the church as to how they're going to provide that comfort. They think if they just deal out the dogma, that should be enough. And it's not hip, it's not cool, it's not sexy, it's not what you're exactly looking for.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what happened in the 1890s. Why are people going to spiritualists and joining folkish swastika cults that say they can, you know, teach you new sciences and ways of reaching your perfect, you know, organic science of the soul? Because the Catholic Church couldn't do it for them anymore.
Yeah.
Right? Protestant, the Lutherans, the Calvinists, all too difficult and boring and traditional. You're right. But, and here's an important argument I make in the book, as bad as traditional religion has been at many points in terms of preventing change, justifying slavery, religious wars, there's always been, at its best, a very complex theological richness to different strains, whether it's Christianity, Islam, and people who really understood they're struggling with spirituality and meaning and working through it within that tradition, which is always changing, but is always grounded in an ancient or medieval longer term history. And what you see happening between the 1890s and the 1930s is this attempt for quick and rapid spiritual sustenance, right? Mm-hmm. Reading cool fantasy novels about Atlantis and then going to some dousing ritual and then going to a Nazi meeting where they all have swastikas talking about how the Jews have a conspiracy to take over the world. And it all maps onto the same in talking about Thor and Odin and world ice theory. It's all these kind of sexier, interesting, easy ways, right, to find sustenance that's outside the bounds of the church, which I think always puts some kind of, you know, there's a control there. I'm not the least bit religious, but I do see the church as playing this conservative role in society. And if you look at Christianity in America today, there's a big difference between America and Europe, right? Mm-hmm. In Europe, it's just been secularization. And the alt-right is not particularly tied to Christianity, right? You do, and the people who are Christian in Europe still go to church, and they're Catholics, or they're Calvinists, they're Lutheran. They can tell you that, and they go to a Lutheran church. Americans have gotten so intellectually lazy, so theologically lazy, they'd much rather go to some mega church where everyone just tells them, we all believe that Jesus is the Savior, and read six pages of scripture, than worry through what does it mean to be a Baptist versus a Methodist versus a Lutheran? What is my tradition? That's all too boring and, as you say, not sexy.
Right. I don't disagree with that at all. Not at all. I want to switch gears on you here, Eric. I'm gonna do a 180 on you here.
No problem.
I want to go from the church to back to the supernatural. Yet a different type of belief. I want to go to, and this is one that I think we've already sufficiently pissed off enough Christians. Let's sufficiently piss off some witches, shall we? We have a lot of people from the witch community, from the Wiccan community.
Can I say something real quick?
Sure.
I just was trying to make the case that Christians per se were at least a little bit insulated from the supernatural imaginary. That if you were a devout Lutheran or Catholic, mm-hmm. you were highly unlikely to embrace all the ideas that many of the more devout Nazis embraced because they were rejecting that. So yes, I'm not religious, but I'm not arguing that Christianity per se is the same as the kind of occult or esoteric or pagan thinking that Nazism was exploiting. But Christianity can be a bridge to that kind of thinking. That's all. Just as Islam can. Okay. That's so. I don't want to say. I mean, I'm sure Christians will be pissed off. For regardless, but, well, but let's differentiate Christianity from the stuff we're talking about.
Sure,
because
sure.
We're different.
Not yeah. a problem. Now, the Nazis obviously are at a point thinking that we can use or utilize witchcraft in our military plan to get what we need or get what we want to our ultimate goal. At what point do they decide that this is a viable weapon or a viable use to give them some sort of advantage? How do they come about it? What's the start of it, and how do they delve right. into it?
They don't utilize – I mean, so witchcraft per se, they don't think they're going to cast spells and win wars. The fascination with witchcraft, which ties in a lot of what we've already been saying, it's got two major or important kind of what would the word be? Two important outcomes, right, for the Nazis. The tradition of witchcraft ends up influencing two different kinds of policies or ways of thinking. Let's put it that way, mm-hmm. which correlate but are not the same thing. On the one hand, to come back to religion, many Nazis, Himmler, Hess, Dare, Rosenberg, to some degree, even Heydrich, who's one of the more secular thinking Nazis, all truly believe Hitler. I should throw that in there, Hitler as well, that Christianity is an attempt by the Jews, who could not, as a separate race, dominate the world. So they create this Christian religion, which is a watered down form of Judaism, right? It's a Jew who invents it. He spreads it to non-Jews to suppress and control Gentiles who, if they just, invoke their inner Thor, would destroy these silly Semites and take over and realize their full potential like they did in the prehistory when they were running around with axes and wearing bearskins, right? So the Jews invent Christianity. The Catholic Church becomes the institutional center of Christianity, of course, run by Jews. And when they get enough power in the Middle Ages, they see all these beautiful German women running around in the woods casting spells and worshiping Freya and Frey and Thor and Odin. And men are, fascinated by them and they're all doing their thing and they're great warriors and they're having fun and they're going to the mountains and, that are in Faust and running around naked and dancing. And they see this and they say, well, this is paganism and witchcraft and their heretics, we've got to eliminate it. And for Dare and Himmler and all these others, that was an excuse. By labeling them witches and heretics, they could eliminate Aryan, pure, Indo-European culture that had, was an amalgam of Nordic and Northern Indian traditions that were noble and pure and based on blood and soil and forests and spells and Thor and stars and swastikas. They would eliminate that either by just murdering the women who are at the center of these pagan fertility cults, or converting them and their men and creating good Christians who would then be subordinate to the church and no longer find their inner Thor or Valkyrie or whatever. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
So they were studying that as an example of how Jews use subtle institutional conspiracy-ridden methods to dominate and exterminate Aryans. So Heydrich and the SD, which is a subsection of the SS, the intelligence service, most of these crazy things were pursued by Himmler directly through something called the SS Annenerbe, the Institute for Ancestral Research. He had hundreds, eventually thousands, maybe, of scientists and co-workers and grants working with other scientific institutes researching the heritage of Aryans, which included trips to Tibet and looking for the Holy Grail and all this stuff. But in this case, he farmed out the witch research, thousands of documents on witch trials and cases, including his own ancestors, who he does have some evidence that one of his ancestors was killed as a witch. That was done, one of the premises, of course, was he was researching ancient pagan culture and religion, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect of it, which we've already talked about. But the other is, this is what Jews and the Catholics and Freemasons do to kill Germans. So now that we know how they're going to try to kill us, and we're ramping up for an existential war against Jewish Bolshevism and the Catholic Church and Freemasons, we know how to turn the tables on them. So it became a way of both justifying the circular logic and developing methods for exterminating one's enemy. And who was at the center of that? The Jews. So the studying of witchcraft trials in the early modern period wasn't just, let's get back in touch with our inner pagan and Thor. That's part of it, and that's where the Holy Grail comes from and all that stuff. It was also opposition research on how do you police and destroy your enemy the way they tried to do to us. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. One of the things you say, though, one of the things that you're talking about that kind of contradicts one of their beliefs is the belief that Christianity was started by some Jews to rope in Gentiles, yet at the same time they're fascinated by the Holy Grail and the power that it may possess. Why is that?
Not a contradiction in their mental universe, which is a broad one. Okay, so there are French and British occultists who believe some version of what I'm about to say, but it's the German and Austrian ones who really pick it up, politicize it, and in the Third Reich give lots of money and grants to research it. And here's the idea. And Otto Rahn, by the way, the real Indiana Jones, he really existed. He was a really bright, esoteric, ultimately openly gay philologist who was not really that pro-Nazi, but he ended up getting money from the SS and working with Himmler because of his ideas. So let's get into those and why he was in what he did in terms of his research on the Holy Grail.
Sure.
For the paganists, or most generous, some of the German Christians in the Third Reich, and there were so many different strains of paganism kind of the 19th century. The closest to traditional Christianity was the German Christian movement. So they were willing to try to pull some Protestants along, but they were also willing to get rid of the Old Testament for reasons we just discussed, Jews. How is that Christian, right? I mean, that's what led to the schism in the Protestant church in the Third Reich. The German Christians, who were still attempting to kind of, you know, monopolize Lutherans, were like, well, we can't study the Old Testament because that's all Jews. Jesus is an Aryan from some lost Aryan tribe, so the New Testament's okay if we Aryanize it, but the Old Testament's bad. And then you just get more and more nuts from there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus was balder and celebrated a winter solstice and came from a tribe of blonde Aryans who were in Persia, whatever. But the important thing here is they almost all believed, as many occultists in France and Germany and Austria believed, that the Holy Grail, what we call the Holy Grail, was either symbolically or in reality some kind of tradition or magical symbolic emblem that represented the ancient Indo-Aryan religions of northern India that had migrated there to Tibet after the great flood that destroyed Atlantis. So for the Aryans, they didn't call it Atlantis, they called it Thule, right? The Thule civilization, Hyperborea. Iceland, or maybe some lost island outside of Iceland, or maybe it was Helgoland, who cares? There was an ancient civilization. They mated with, you know, primitive peoples or the aliens that inspired them. Their seed disappeared. There was a flood or an ice age, or we're not quite sure what. It collapsed. The world seas rose. The only place they could flee to was Tibet because it was so high. They then mated with locals there and created all these great civilizations in Japan and India. And their religious traditions were preserved in Tibet and made their way back via the Holy Grail, whether it's a dove or a symbol. Again, I'm not a theologian. They had all these arguments for what it might have been. But it got preserved, whether it's a tradition or a thing, by the ancient Indo-Aryan Tibetan Buddhist culture, came in via Persia, which was always also supposedly a great Indo-Aryan culture, and then made its way through southern Europe up into southern France, where the Cathars, the Albigensians, a heretical group that the church decided they were going to eliminate, were practicing a religion based on the Grail and or hid the actual Grail. Remember, they're trying to investigate whether there is a physical Grail in Mont Segur, a mountain down in the Pyrenees. And Ron believed all this stuff and went to Mont Segur, you know, with his French occult friends, and wrote a book in 33, coincidentally enough, called Crusade for or Against the Grail, depending on how you translate it, basically about the search for the Grail and its origins in Indo-Aryan Tibetan religion. Himmler and a bunch of Nazis read it and were like, this is great. Let's hire this guy. The SS will give him lots of money and sponsor his research to find what it is exactly the Grail was, what is its link to this Indo-Aryan religion. What's its link to this culture, pagan culture that we Christians call witchcraft? And let's reconstruct all of that. And what I'm saying is there's contingency there. They're researching it. They don't have an exact idea, but you see how all of this ties together.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow.
So that's how you reconcile the Grail, because it's not traditionally Christian. It's not the cup of Christ. It's something else entirely. Which the Christians themselves, I think these Nazis would say, wanted to appropriate, or the true kind of Aryan Christians, or the heretics, because the Albigensians, the Cathars, were technically Christian, but they were really practicing a Gnostic form of religion, which some called Luciferianism, that Lucifer is actually the god of light and did a lot of good things, mm-hmm. And that's why in his second book, Ron basically calls it Lucifer's Court. That the real religion of pagan Germans, which was this Tibetan Indo-Aryan religion, was a religion of Lucifer, of light. And Lucifer's a good guy. Now you can imagine what Christians thought of that. So there you go.
I can't imagine they got along too well over that, to be honest with you.
They did not like it.
Now, there's two other things I want to tackle with you here before we leave each other tonight. The other kind of ties into the whole witchcraft thing via powerful objects like the Holy Grail. And that has to do – we've touched on it a little bit already tonight. You've kind of mentioned it once or twice in passing, and that is these miracle weapons that they believe could be manufactured. Now, at the time, the atomic bomb almost could have been looked at as a miracle weapon. Would you have considered – the atomic bomb to be one of these miracle weapons that the Nazis were working on?
Right. So without getting too much, again, into the weeds or historiography here, there are a lot of historians who say that this period of the early 20th century is a period of miraculous thinking, not just based in irrationality, but on all these new technologies, the possibilities of the atom, that we now understood, quantum mechanics, things that are very small, relativity, things that are very large. And that caused people, based on reality of actual science, to start thinking in miraculous ways. What can we harness? What can we do? It's almost magical, right? I'm not arguing in this part of the book that the Nazis' miraculous thinking is grounded in reality. What I'm focusing on, because the Germans were at the forefront until they kicked out many of their Jewish scientists, but even after, right, Max Planck and Heisenberg, of traditional or mainstream natural science, the Nazis didn't get rid of natural science. They simply tried to meld it through Himmler's Annenerbe and other ways with border science, this Grenzwissenschaft that's really grounded in occultism and faith-based thinking. And my interest in that chapter is to look at the ways that by reporting to supernatural thinking or these doctrines we've been talking about, right, of theosophy, ariosophy, dowsing, parapsychology, anti-gravity, for which they didn't have any real evidence, they undermine their ability to come up with actual miraculous weapons, right? Mm-hmm. So I have a point in the chapter where I show, Hitler and Himmler independently, didn't show up for meetings about atomic energy, but were fascinated by, death rays and laser guns and, giant rockets that would be fueled by anti-gravity, because that fit their science fiction view of the world. And atomic energy not only was very complex and seemingly expensive and difficult to come up with, but they linked it to Jews like Einstein who came up with relativity, and therefore it's Jewish science, and we're not quite sure we want to invest billions of dollars in that right now. Rockets, which any 12-year-old with a comic book can draw, you know, that was the kind of thing, reading science fiction in the 20s and 30s and investigating, you know, death rays and lasers and superpowers that people who had a third eye could use. Those are the kinds of things. So Himmler had people looking to see in ancient, you know, Nordic tradition, if it's possible that the electrical energies that Thor used were really some kind of hidden energy that could be discovered and harnessed, not, you know, actual electromagnetic forces, but some kind of hidden Nordic mystical energy linked to the things that dowsers found under the earth or supposedly cosmic rays or what have you. He was wasting time on stuff like this. He hired a company called Elamog to research this and said, you know, maybe Thor's hammer is based in reality instead of atomic weapons. He hired a guy named Victor Schauberger, who actually had an audience with Hitler in 1934, because he was, you know, he was an Austrian. So at the time, Austria was independent, and it wasn't quite clear if Mussolini was going to take it over or Germany. So he had met with Mussolini, and some people around Hitler said, you know, we don't want him to get all of Schauberger's great ideas about using water and hidden forces and anti-gravity to create weapons and energy, right? Mm-hmm. So why don't you meet with them? And Hitler's secretary is like, this guy's nuts, you know, he's not giving us any real basis for his ideas. And Hitler, it turns out from the protocols afterwards, was less angry about the bad science and more angry that he wouldn't reveal his secrets directly to him and may have to Mussolini, and that's why he, for a couple of years, he wanted nothing to do with them. But he pops back up a few years later, working with some major German manufacturers, and then the SS basically force him to do experiments with anti-gravity and possibly low-level radiation experiments to develop weapons, which, you know, in kind of the fanciful world of crypto history is the bell, this weird swastika thing that you see sometimes in comic books and movies that supposedly could levitate, and then in Operation Paperclip, we stole the technology for and hid in Area 51. By the way, there's, again, connections between the kind of thinking we see in the Third Reich and, you know, supernatural thinking today, conspiracy right. thinking, this idea that Operation Paperclip, you know, Schauberger and all, we have no evidence he actually came up with any, you know, usable weapon, but the supernatural thinking behind it may have undermined the war effort, right? The manpower put into this stuff. And Speer, who was the armaments minister, is complaining constantly about it. I spent a lot of time in the chapter where Speer, who, by the way, is an architect. He wasn't, you know, trained as a scientist, but he was smart enough to recognize that a lot of this stuff was either not going to have any effect or, in the case of the V-1 and V-2, could terrorize some British civilians, but probably wasn't going to win the war in 44 and 45. And you've got Himmler and Goebbels and all these other Nazi leaders, some of whom are using it as propaganda because they see the Germans as gullible. Others actually believe that these are miracle weapons that are going to solve everything, right? Mm. And it's Götterdämmerung, it's Twilight of the Gods, and either they're going to have total victory out of nowhere or total defeat. This is not the kind of miracle weapons based on atomic reality. It's based in a realm of fantasy, right? So I want to be careful of differentiating the real miraculous thinking of, wow, we can harness the power of the atom, for example,
right,
from the kinds of thinking based in fairy tales or occultism or border science that influences some of the stuff they're doing in 44, 43, 44, 45 under the aegis of the SS.
Okay. Lastly tonight, this is the one I wanted to hold over for everybody. The story of werewolves versus vampires. That's all I'll mention, and I'll let you take it from there. It's a little hard to swallow, but go ahead.
So let me give you the backstory here, too. So the whole point, obviously, of this book, which is very much a survey of all these things, is to show how the ideas kind of gestate in the 19th century, become pretty popular, and then become politicized and even weaponized in the Third Reich. So what you see in the folklore resurgence, right, the Grimm brothers and this interest in Indo-Aryan religion and Buddhism and, you know, Thor and Odin, which is Wagner, right? This is all what's going on in the mid to late 19th century. Alongside this resurgence of interest in folklore, as you see in the Romantic era in Britain and France, is an interest in vampires and werewolves. What's fascinating about the Central European deployment of these, you know, new ideas is that werewolves are very clearly, by the late 19th century, early 20th century, appearing as a maybe chaotic but positive figure in German folklore. Werewolves, like witches, are an authentic Germanic tradition. Odin had his berserkers who would, some say, whether it was bear skins or wolf skins, would throw them on and turn into wolves and help defend, you know, Asgard. Werewolves, actual folklore tradition shows some of them were good. You know, they'd help maidens through the forest. They'd, you know, find food for starving peasants. So werewolves, according to the way folklore was received, I'm not saying this is authentic, became positive. We even have someone who worked for Alfred Rosenberg, one of the Nazi leaders, who wrote a dissertation on the werewolf in German tradition, which more or less argued what I just said, that werewolves are good. And at some point in that dissertation, and you see this in the wider culture, vampires, he contrasts werewolves with vampires. Vampires are Slavic or Jewish. They're Eastern. They're diseased. They're undead. They're not authentic kind of forest creatures who are just, you know, the expression of German masculinity, the way witches are German femininity. They're these evil, corrupt, bizarre, racially degenerate creatures who are powerful but dangerous, hide in the dark, conspire in the shadows. And there's already a tradition before 33 of linking vampires to Jews and Slavs. In Nosferatu, many people have read the version of Bram Stoker's Dracula. He's not some handsome guy who seduces women. He's this disgusting, undead, Jewish-looking, Slavic creature from the East, right, who comes west and poisons blonde women and destroys whole towns with his plague. And then you see in Mein Kampf, Hitler used the term bloodsucker or vampire all the time for Jews. And so here's that's the tradition. So when you know that tradition, and then in the 20s and 30s, you see paramilitary groups that call themselves the werewolves who are fighting against the Weimar Republic, which is supposedly led by liberals and socialists and Jews, and getting arrested and, you know, sacrificing themselves for the folk. And then in the 30s, you have this guy named Hermann Lohns, who wrote a book called Werewolf, 1910 or 11, about the Reformation, when all these German peasants whose families are being murdered by the Catholic Church, we come back to the witchcraft thing, right? And they're, you know, they're devout Protestants or paganists, and they create bands that hide in the woods and call themselves werewolves and come out at night and kill these, you know, counter-Reformation armies. That book becomes hugely popular in the 20s, and the Nazis love it, and they reprint. There are hundreds of thousands of copies that sell in the Third Reich. So there's just a tradition of the positive werewolf and the Slavic Jewish vampire. And then what happens in World War II now that you've got a war? Near the end of the war, when they're coming up, this is our last-ditch effort. Things are not looking good. Even Hitler and Himmler, as crazy as they were, like, well, you know, we've got to put it all on the table. They come up with one last partisan group, which is going to be special forces to the nth degree. They hire this guy named Hans Adolf Prutzmann, who had distinguished himself by being a fantastic, you know, special forces guy in the Ukraine killing communists, and this guy named Otto Skorzeny, who famously rescued Mussolini, the greatest special forces leader in the SS, paratrooper, also, by the way, involved in the occult enterprise of all these dowsers who were trying to find Mussolini. They get these two guys together and say, look, Himmler's come up with this great idea. We're going to call you werewolves. You're going to hide out in the woods. You're going to be like wolves of prey, Hitler calls them. Wolves attacking, you know, beasts attacking your prey, which are the Allies, and Germans who want to, you know, surrender to the Allies. and you're going to run around the woods like these crazy special forces fighting against Soviet partisans coming in from the east and the Allies coming in from the west. Goebbels sets up a werewolf radio station where he broadcasts all over Central Europe saying the werewolves are coming, and this woman goes, "Ooh," and makes a werewolf sound, and it's supposed to scare the crap out of everybody. So Goebbels, Himmler, and Hitler, kind of the unholy trinity at the end, are all agreed, we're going to call ourselves werewolves. Can you see Roosevelt or Churchill setting that up as a last guess? I mean, it's clearly a supernatural thing with a long tradition in Germany. And then we get to the vampires. So while they're setting this up in late 44, early 45, we're getting report after report collected by none other than a high-ranking SS folklorist who made his name categorizing Jews and Slavs and deciding who was Germanic enough not to be killed or resettled in Poland, a guy who studies folklore and fairy tales and thinks that German fairy tales talk about werewolves and cool ghosts that protect you. Slavic fairy tales are vampires and whatever. This guy is collecting stories on behalf of the SS of Germans, ethnic Germans, fleeing west, from the communists in Yugoslavia, right? The Yugoslavia, you know, Tito, communist partisans fighting alongside, you know, the communist generals, Stalin and everything. And these Germans are claiming, and we have dozens of accounts of this from normal German peasants, that the Slavs that they used to be, you know, neighbors with, never really liked, whatever, they got along, are turning into vampires, bloodsuckers, and saying, we want to drink Slavian blood, and running around in the woods and attacking them and trying to suck their blood and killing them and ripping them apart and trying to destroy ethnic Germans. And that's why they're fleeing west, to escape this. So you literally have this end game of World War II. I'm not saying this defined the entire Central European theater. Mm-hmm. The Nazis creating werewolves as positive partisans to fight against communists, and the Germans fleeing from the communists saying that the communists are turning into vampires and trying to suck their blood with superhuman strength. If that doesn't show you how this whole thing is viewed towards, you know, through the lens of the supernatural, I don't know what does. Right, and all of this is empirically based in archival research. I'm not making any of this up.
I think there was too much absinthe flowing over there, Eric. That's what I think.
Yeah, well, that happened. That's chapter 9. So I hope your audience enjoyed these kind of tidbits from the book and want to read more.
Absolutely. The book is Hitler's Monsters, A Supernatural History of the Third Reich. It's available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and all fine booksellers. We have a link up right now at PodcastOne.com on the Beyond the Darkness page, and you can find it very, very easily there as well. Eric Kurlander is the author and our guest. Eric, thank you very much for being with us tonight. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Tim. This was fun.
Thank you. Folks, Dave is back next week, but you can see him this weekend along with me at Michigan Paracon. The tickets are available right now, just a few of them left at Keewaun Casinos, and it started today, so get your tickets right now. Go to darknessevents.com, click on the banner, and get them while you can, and we'll see you out there. It's going to be a great time. Tomorrow, we have a very interesting program. George Dudding joins us. Devil Monkey is what we'll be talking about. It's a creature that roams the U.S. In fact, it may even be in your backyard. And it's not just a monkey. It's a monkey, it's a kangaroo, and it's many other combinations as well. And believe it or not, it may take off with your kids or a part of you when you least expect it. It's a devil monkey, and it's coming up tomorrow on the best in paranormal talk radio. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis, and this is Beyond the Darkness.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.